You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. The UK has had a long history of strange encounters with black, hulking shapes that leave witnesses shaken to their core. For some, this history is being misinterpreted to try and suggest that Bigfoot has crossed the Atlantic. For many others, however, the interactions suggest a continuation of the centuries-old ghostly monks. Yet, even for some, this doesn't explain it all. Could these shapes be the Fae, Boggarts, the Universal Trickster, or something else entirely? 14 Times contributor and lover of the strange, Stu Neville returns to join me as we try to unpick this unholy mess of high strangeness. Before that, don't forget you can support Mysteries and Monsters by going to patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters to sign up for $4 a month, ad-free episodes, guaranteed early releases, bonus content and more awaits you. You can also click the link in the show notes to sign up there. Mysteries and Monsters is also across all social media platforms, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, and please subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube. You can also visit mysteriesandmonsters.com. News, updates, and episodes await. Thank you as always to Dean Bessel for his marvellous artwork. The show is produced by Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys. And Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange Network. People are seeing something, and it seems no one explanation fits the bill. Just what on earth is going on? It seems something strange is being reported by some people across the British Isles that has got British Fortians and cryptozoologists scratching their heads. People are allegedly claiming to be encountering giant, shadowy figures that for some prove that Bigfoot has moved across the Atlantic. For many others, however, the evidence points to something far stranger indeed. And I'm delighted to welcome back Fortian Stu Neville to shine a light on this perplexing conundrum. Stu, it's been too long, sir. How are we?
It's been way too long. I'm very, very well, thank you, Paul. Very well. It's good to get to catch up. It has been far too long. It's been a weird couple of years, hasn't it? It kind of different time has been stretched and truncated, and it's kind of strange. But yes, it's very good. I'll be listening to the show. The show is, of course, brilliant, and fabulous guests. I fairly recommend it. And then you get people like Freeman and me just to bring the tone down again. So yeah, it's a good balance. Good balance.
Well, that's very kind of you. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
So, Stu, you and I have got to know each other quite well over the last few years. This is a subject that I have to try and remember to stay in my lane about, because there are very few Fortian subjects that fire me up as much as this in regards to some of the alleged explanations that are being put forward. One of the things I found quite frustrating, and you can see this with a lot of phenomena, is that there seems to be a bit of rewriting of history that's going on here as well in regards to how some people are viewing these strange encounters. So as someone who's knee-deep in all kinds of Fortian mysteries, why on earth have you decided to prick the boil of this strange situation?
I don't know. It's some sort of masochism, I think. I really do. It's one of those things you think... You're right. You do kind of scratch the surface and you think, okay, there's always been the wild man motif. Yeah. So there's always been the Woodwows. There's always been this in Britain. There's always been the idea of the wild man. So it's not an alien concept to us, but certainly for the last 100 years or so, all man beasts have been very much Pacific Northwest, Himalayas, Yowies. Perhaps to they're becoming better known now, but to a lesser extent. So it's always the Abominable Snowman and Bigfoot, basically, wasn't it? Right up till the 90s, effectively. But there's always been these reports of things happening in the UK. Now, the thing is, what struck me at the time, and I remember the first time I heard one described, and they said that it was this, the usual classic thing. It's an 8-foot black bulky shape with a pointed head, which kind of moves silently and sometimes has red eyes and a great feeling of foreboding around it.
Yeah.
Now, the thing is, all you have to do, funny enough, the first time I heard that description, I had literally just read Colin Wilson's Poltergeist about the Black Monk of Pontefract.
Fabulous
which is which is described as an 8-foot black shape with a pointy head and, you know, that with a great sense of foreboding about it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's starting to think, well, perhaps this is something that we're putting cultural spins on.
Yeah.
As much as anything else. Now, I want to say right from the start, this doesn't, you know how much I hate blanket explanations.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not trying to say that this is the answer to everything because I don't think it is. But I think that there is a long and very, very venerable tradition of these things being seen in the UK and indeed in Western Europe. But I think because Bigfoot is the thing du jour and has been since the sort of like 2000s, cryptozoology has been the big thing.
Yeah.
Everybody just immediately sees a big black shape in the woods and thinks Bigfoot.
Mm.
And that's it, which is understandable, completely understandable. So I started doing some research and basically digging into it. And I started looking back at the old sort of like the paper archives and stuff like that, including the one that was seen in Tunbridge Wells, which was quite amazing. And, there was this like sort of wooded area quite close to Royal Tunbridge Wells, and people kept on seeing these 8-foot tall, covered in hair, red demonic eyed thing when people were fishing or walking there. And it's always dog walkers, isn't it?
Yeah,
dog walkers. Anything macabre has ever found is by a dog walker. And it's like they found the body, they found this, they saw that, whatever, they got abducted. It's always dog walkers. Anyway, and they see these things, and there was a lot of them, and they reported it because, bless them, because you report it to the local paper, because just in case you don't want any ridicule, you know. And then Kent Online turned up, and there's a fabulous article. You can find it online, a brilliant picture, and it basically shows this wooded area, and in comparison, it shows Tunbridge Wells High Street, all right, just so you can tell the two apart. And this is Tunbridge Wells, this is the wooded area. Well, thank you very much, you know. If you spot it on the high street, I'm sure more people would probably spot it, you know. Hey ho. But this really took off because this was 2012, just after the Olympics. So, because you remember what the Olympics was like. It was this fever pitch, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And everybody was so G'd up and it was a nice summer and everybody was, and then kind of it all slumped, didn't it? Because bugger all happened after the Olympics. Nothing happened in 2012 at all, but, you know, after the Olympics. And then suddenly a Bigfoot gets spotted in Tunbridge Wells. So stuff kinds of takes off. And then people started to say, well, actually, no, they've seen things being seen for years. And there've been a history of them. Certainly going back to the First World War, people have been basically saying it. But of course, mostly in those days, they didn't say anything about it. They just get very, very quiet.
Mm.
It's only since social media really has come out that people have started to say, we're seeing these things. These things are going on. Because with social media, it's a lot easier to find like minds. It's far, far easier to connect with people. You know, it's got a lot to answer for, but in terms of connection, you know, it's much better than trying to put an advert in the local paper and hoping that somebody in, you know, 100 miles away sees it, because they wouldn't.
Mm.
Sure, taking out an advert in the Times and sort of proclaiming it to the rooftops,
yes,
you'd never find them. Now, Google it, bingo, you'll find them, you know. And so it is, in that respect, it's very good. It's good for researchers like ourselves to be able to find stuff. So, This started to sort of coalesce around this area. And then the stuff started coming out about Bolam Lake as well, which has again got a very, very long history about it.
Mm.
You know, and obviously the CFZ actually investigated that as well. And a lot of them said, you know, it depends who you believe. Nick Redfern said there was glimpses of stuff by the CFZ.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, others have said, well, no, it was more a sense of foreboding. And this is often how it tends to come out. Because the sense of foreboding was something that Ron Moorhead mentioned with you, wasn't it?
Yes.
It's like that fact that you know they're there. You can't see them. You bloody know they're there. And you know how big they are. And you know how imposing. It's what Douglas Adams referred to when he said when he met, he went up to see gorillas. He said, you feel that you're being watched by a truck.
Mm.
That was his actual word. And he said, it's just, you know, there's this massive presence there. Which is going, which could completely flatten you.
Mm.
That's how they described it at Bolam. And they did a proper thing. And, you know, they recorded all kinds of weird electromagnetic things. All of this plays into it and so forth. But anyway, to wind it back a bit, and obviously that there is a very, very long tradition, of woodwoods in the UK. There's this great sort of idea that the whole of Great Britain was forested. you know, up until the Middle Ages, which isn't actually true. There were, you know, obviously there's moorlands, and obviously there was agricultural land, but however, it was possible, apparently, just to get from the New Forest to the top end of Sherwood, round your way,
yep,
and not to actually break tree cover.
Mm.
There would have been the odd road, the odd clearing, but other than that, there was a line of forest you could have followed, where many of these reports used to emanate from. And there's lots and lots of references to them in psalters, you know, the sort of the old church books and stuff like that, pictures of them. But they're normally seen as part of nature. And there's a lot of debate about whether the Green Man is actually a Woodrose, whether the Woodrose is actually a representation of the Green Man, where they just happen to look like each other and stuff like that. That's a one for the historians to actually argue about, the archaeologists. But it's a lot of correlations. And in fact, if you look at Woodrose, they tend to look more human. They don't tend to look particularly ape-like.
Yeah.
They're hairy people, basically, often wearing a fig leaf and carrying a club. Mm. Almost invariably carrying a club. They were tooled up, basically. Yeah, but they do. They look like people, basically, who are just overly hairy, don't they?
Yes.
And that's it. And they're mentioned all over the place. And Gawain the Green Knight, they mentioned, you know, there's a wood was that wound in the Narrows, which means a wood was lived in the rocks, in what would now be the Wirral. It's kind of, places have their traditions of them. There's one not far from me, actually, in Bath, which is called the Beast of Brass Knocker Hill. And there's one also in Lee Woods, which is actually opposite, very, very close to the Clipton Suspension Bridge. And to this day, that there's occasional reports of basically an ape. People see this stuff. And again, it's always the bloody dog walkers, or it's joggers. It's quite popular. And in fact, believe it or not, Carol Vorderman used to have one of the houses backing onto this huge tract of forest. And quite often there'd be people hanging around there because apparently they were looking for giant apes and not trying to look for Carol Vorderman's back patio doors. But let's not go into that one. What are you doing? I'm hunting for Woodrose. Right, okay. You got a camera. Mm, yes. You know. Happened a lot, apparently. So certainly back in, taking it back to the sort of like the 14, 1500s, certainly back then it would have been a reasonable habitat for a large, you know, a large omnivore. I mean, we still had bears, we still had wolves at that point. Mm. We all still lived here then. And to be honest, if you could support bears and wolves, as is the Pacific Northwest argument, it could probably support a flesh and blood Bigfoot. The problem is now, post-industrial revolution, it really couldn't support a large unknown omnivore. It just couldn't do it.
Mm.
Okay, black cats are a good example, but black cats are incredibly stealthy. Black cats can hide. We know they can because they escape. And also, the other thing about the difference between black cats and Bigfoot is we know that black cats actually do exist because we've seen them. they're in zoos. They're a real thing. I would count ABCs aren't really cryptozoology. They're out of place animals.
Yeah.
They're existent animals we know about. They just happen to be in a place we don't expect them to be. Whereas Bigfoot's a different thing slightly. And so it makes it an ongoing viable habitat isn't really a going concern in the UK, even in the wilds of Scotland, really. However, the problem is people are seeing them. And this is where the whole thing starts. So again, as usual, I've just given you a 15-minute answer to your open question.
That's all right. That's all right. You see, the thing about this is the conundrum about all of this, be it Yowies, Bigfoot, Sasquatch, or whatever's going on here.
Mm.
None of these three places have a native ape population. Apes died off in Europe. Obviously, there are some apes in Gibraltar, and obviously private collections, and occasionally animals will escape, as we're often aware of. But great apes in Europe died out 9 million years ago. I think they were mostly found in Germany, which I think was the Gryphopithecus, I think it is, and the Australopithecus, I think.
Yeah.
Don't hold me to my pronunciation there, Stu.
Oh, don't worry.
And they both died out, for as far as we're aware, 9 million years ago. And that vacuum was obviously filled up by other omnivores, bears, wolves, all kinds of creatures. So obviously the other aspect of this is that Britain is an island.
Yes.
There is no way that anything could get here other than swimming, because let's be honest, there's no land bridge. And even if we go back to the days of Doggerland and the end of the last ice age, where it was technically possible to walk from England to France, even so, we still don't have matching reports coming from continental Europe at all. So the whole aspect of this is, I have to put my cards firmly on the table. I have absolutely
cast iron beliefs that whatever's going on here is not flesh and blood. Because yes. I know enough about natural biology and the way animals are tagged and managed in the UK that if we had a large, hairy, bipedal hominid that was partial to a bit of mutton or venison now and again, Stu, it would be front page news. And often,
yes,
more often than not, we come across animal carcasses and things that are often blamed on, as you mentioned earlier, the ABCs, and yet we also know that ABCs are not very partial to sheep because they don't like the wool.
No.
They prefer cows and other such animals.
Pigs
and things like that. So when you look at it all, I think it's a real mess that's developed, especially over the last 20 years, I think, by certain conversations being created, especially in the modern era with YouTube.
Yep.
And social media that is appealing to people from North America. And I mean this with the nicest respect in the world, that quite a lot of people know next to nothing about the geography of the UK. And as you touched on, I've had conversations with people from North America who broach this subject with me. And I say, well, there's no areas that these creatures could possibly be. Even in the wilds of Scotland, they couldn't be there. Even the North Yorkshire Moors, they couldn't be there. The Forest of Dean, wherever. There is no area that is big enough to support anything.
Nope.
Obviously, we have the issues that we do have large creatures hiding in plain sight, as we've mentioned ABCs, but we've also got wild boars running amok in the Forest of Dean, who are incredibly stealthy and also very dangerous. And I think that's a ticking time bomb down there, that we are going to get a situation where someone is going to come a cropper sooner or later, unfortunately.
Yes.
Because their numbers are out of control.
Totally. And interestingly, they were there for very long. We've got friends who live in Colford, which is outside Colford. And people knew. Oh, they just completely accepted the wild boar were there. Everybody knew the bloody wild boar were there. They got seen all the time. Farmers saw them all the time. Foresters saw them all the time. The only people who wouldn't accept they were there were the Ministry of Agriculture, because the problem is the Ministry of Agriculture, as soon as they acknowledged them, would be forced to do something about them. And so for a very, very long time, the Min of Ag and Fish, or whatever they were in those days, just refused to acknowledge it as an alien. And you'd get people who, for God's sake, in fact, our friends, one of their neighbours ran one over, actually hit it with a car, and just took it into town, took it into Colford, took it to the vet and said, what is this? They said, it's a wild boar. There's loads of them. Don't worry, you know, it's, you know, we know they're there. They see it. But you're right, they're stealthy. They could be 10 feet away from you. You wouldn't know. And I gave the example the other week, but funnily enough, I'd take our own cat to the vet just for a checkup. And she got into back garden. I'd locked the cat flap, but no, she was already out. And she was in the back garden. And she was literally 5 feet away from me and I couldn't find her.
Yeah.
Because that's what animals can do. They are that stealthy. And she just hidden her, so she knows where she can hide. You know, and that's in a garden that's 50 feet by 25 feet in the middle of a bloody southeast Bristol suburb. For God's sake, you know, they could do these things. However, if she was 8 foot tall, she wouldn't be able to do that quite as easily. And the other thing, boar are not very tall. Boar are big, but they're as big as a dog at the shoulder, aren't they?
Yeah.
And that's the thing. And it's quite easy. People, we were saying earlier on, don't tend to look down. They don't tend to look up. They tend to look straight ahead pretty much.
Yep.
So unless something grabs your attention from the side, you ain't going to see it. However, since it's as tall as you're bigger, you will see because it's in your line of sight, because that's what human beings do.
Yeah.
And if these things were wandering around, and I really want them. Don't get me wrong. You and I both would love the bloody things to be here. That's fabulous.
Yes.
But it's not happening. And that's the thing. And more people would see them.
Yeah.
This is the other thing. If they were flesh and blood. Now, I am prepared to accept perhaps Woodwas did exist, you know, as a flesh and blood creature. I'm perfectly prepared to believe that they existed. But again, it could be a misidentification of something else going back a couple of millennia. It could easily be, you know.
Absolutely.
It could be all kinds of stuff. And I think the blanket explanation is our biggest enemy, because we have this tendency, even in fortune circles, to go, X is, we've got evidence that, well, not evidence, we have a strong theory, perhaps, that X is this, therefore everything like X must be this as well. And it doesn't work like that.
No.
You know, just because you've disproved one thing doesn't mean it immediately disproves all the others. You have to include that disproof and that process within the ongoing dialogue because that's how science works. That's how you progress. Mm. You eliminate stuff as you're going along, but you can't just immediately say, this is fake, therefore they're all fake.
Absolutely.
You know, that's the problem, you know, and people, as I keep saying, are seeing something.
Yes.
You know, and that's just the thing.
Now,
seeing.
Well, this is the aspect, and I think I've broached this subject a couple of times when I've been speaking with Bigfoot and Sasquatch researchers from North America, especially when we're talking about the alleged interdimensional aspect of them that some people are all in on.
Mm.
And what I've often found interesting, and I've mentioned it, is that, well, if we are to believe the people that are wholly in the opinion that Bigfoots are flesh and blood, and as a lover of the paranormal, I'm more akin to fall towards the side of, well, if they're alive and they are sentient and intelligent and have a culture and a language and a family unit or whatever that we're alleged to believe, if we take the body of evidence that we've collated over the last 50 years, then what's to stop them having ghosts? And why is nobody looking at now? People might think that I'm going even further than the interdimensional aspect. But as a lover of all things Fortean and paranormal, for me, I'm often amazed that that isn't a theory, that people don't consider that what they're encountering is a ghost. Because, I mean, here in the UK, we've at least two famous ape ghosts that are alleged to live there, including the hilariously rude one that lives in Dorset, which is famous for allegedly pleasuring itself to unsuspecting visitors to a particular country home.
Yes.
And then we've also got weird things like the shug monkey that's allegedly been running about for ages, which is a very strange creature that makes no sense at all. But so when we're looking at these kind of aspects of it, the thing about what people, as you refer to, Stuart, using a blanket explanation to try and decide that, well, I believe it's Bigfoot, therefore everything has to be Bigfoot, which the physical body of evidence simply isn't there. And once again, we seem to be having lots of one footprint, which is always a red flag in any aspect.
Oh, God, yeah.
But the thing about this country is, and as you were talking about Woodrow's or the Green Man, when we look back in history, it's often easy to misinterpret descriptions of things or cultural aspects with a modern prism and go, oh, well, that sounds like Bigfoot, therefore it must be, rather than, as you say, the Green Man especially is often seen wearing a fig leaf and seems to have long hair and a beard, not covered in hair, and carrying a club, which would once again point to a level of intelligence above what we would consider to be an animal, even though obviously great apes have been recently discovered to be able to use tools and all kinds of things that we've only recently skimmed the surface of. So for me, those kind of explanations, because we're talking about ancient Britain and there were all kinds of tribes running all over the place in all parts of the United Kingdom, or the separate areas, as it were, because obviously there was no such thing as England or Scotland or Wales until the Romans turned up and decided to try and create these borders. So prior to that, you just had disparate tribes all over the place. What's to say that whatever the Green Man or the Woodrow's historical is, was simply a group of people who just wanted to hang about in the woods out of the way, and that's where their tribe lived. We see it still to this day in the Amazon. So why is that, once again, why is that never aspect of it never brought forward? It's when we talk about these strange sights and encounters from sort of 19th century America, it's like a running joke that there are always people that seem to be suffering some kind of mental illness, or they've had a breakdown and therefore they've run off into the woods and suddenly they've become hairy people. Now, some of them clearly weren't hairy people, because we know people don't go feral. You don't run off to the woods and then all of a sudden turn into hairy creatures like pigs do when they run off. They suddenly remove all the shackles of domesticity to them and become...
They refer really quickly, don't they? When they're generous or two, they're back to being boar again. Yeah, no problem. Very strong things,
I think it's the quickest domesticated animal that goes wild, a pig.
Yeah.
And yet some of these reports are clearly people, as we were saying about that, because a lot of them have red hair and they're all running about wearing just a loincloth or underwear or something, and some of them are described wearing clothing, but not much of it. So but a lot of them were red-headed, and which was a very strange aspect of it.
Yeah.
When we look at this whole thing, I think to somebody to simply say, oh, well, these are clearly Bigfoots that people are saying. And yet, when you look at the description, very few of them describe them as being hairy. They say it's a black hulking shape with a pointed head, which leads us to probably one of the most commonly spotted paranormal aspects or haunted aspects of the UK, which is monks.
Yeah, exactly.
Which are seen all over the United Kingdom. And as you touched on about our good friend, the Black Monk of Pontefract, here where I am in Sheffield, Stockbridge, has been prescribed to be monks and the nonsensical stories about obviously a broken-hearted monk who fell in love with a nun and all that, but there's no abbey and there's no historical records of anybody wandering around here or anything, and that the nearest abbey is 11 miles away and it was destroyed a very long time ago. So you've got that aspect to it, but then you've also got the other interesting point of all this is that nobody's considering the Fae in all this either.
No, they're not. This is another point, because obviously the Fae, everybody just thinks Tinkerbell. This is the problem. The modern view of the Fae tends to be Tinkerbell, or it tends to be things that have come from various programs such as True Blood and so on. So you get the more gothic, modern ones. I mean, it's like vampires have changed, haven't they? Vampires used to be very much, evening dress and sort of like elegance. Then they kind of regressed is the wrong word. Then they sort of developed into being more authentically dressed. So they're wearing more sort of like proper Transylvanian. So like the ornate gowns and stuff like that. And nowadays they wear basically jeans and t-shirts because that's what Twilight's done for it. Well, it's the same with the Fae. The Fae have kind of turned into this slightly feral, more goth looking thing than anything else.
Mm.
But ultimately it's just a modern spin on exactly the same old thing, isn't it? And it's basically a modern interpretation. The Fae, because they're slightly, traditionally the Fae are chaotic, neutral. They're not good. They're not bad. They just don't care about people.
Mm.
And it's that which people find the hardest to deal with, I think, isn't it? It's the same with all the kind of legends of elementals, Fae, et cetera, et cetera. It's not that they don't like people. It's not that they're antipathetic towards people. They just use people for what they want. They don't care about people. Mm. And this is a wider thing. This is why a lot of people find it very hard to embrace something like atheism, for example, because they want to think the universe somehow cares about them. Whereas in fact, nature and the universe doesn't give a toss about us. You know what I mean? We are a part of nature. We're part of the instrument, we're part of the great big, living astrolabe that is the earth. But at the same time, have we got individual meaning? Well, this is way off the topic, but... But this is the thing with the Fae. The Fae are kind of like an instrument of that, aren't they? And the Fae are kind of seen as, they're omnipresent and they're always there. And they're not always got our best interests at heart. But that's a very, very personal, subjective thing.
And I think often it's confusing as well, because depending on your point of view or where you are in the world, you will often try and prescribe your historical folklore on a different country, which doesn't work, because I've heard people, in regards to what's going on here with these strange hulking shapes being seen, that people say, oh, well, it's the djinn. Well, what's that going to be the djinn?
Exactly.
What's the djinn? How have the djinn got here? I appreciate that their home base is the Middle East and that those areas around there. That's not to say that they've not travelled the world as people have moved.
Yeah.
But you can't start prescribing a different area's folklore to a country that's already... We've already got magical creatures here, thank you very much.
Exactly,
and even in this, as you touched on there about how the Fae are viewed, even if you go to Ireland, England, Scotland and Wales, all four countries, even in England, the Fae in the north are different to the Fae in the south. There is no consensus about how they believe. The ones in Scotland are supposed to be quite vicious if you meet the wrong ones.
Yeah.
And then there are two types. You've got different ones in the north. You've got, even if you look at things like the Knockers in Cornwall.
Yes.
And nothing like what people report over in Norfolk and Suffolk.
Hello.
So even in the UK, you have, once again, different tribes based on different localities and different areas that have long traditions of very distinctive folklore.
Yes, they do. And this is another sort of strand to this thing, because there was an FT piece about Boggarts a while back. I started writing, as one about Boggarts a couple of years ago, and I got kind of sidetracked by COVID more than anything else. It just And somebody else, which is fine, somebody else picked up bad and did a better job of it than I was doing, to be honest. Bogarts do play a part in this, because if you take Bogarts as something which absorb energy from people. And the first time I really sort of encountered this idea was Tom Lethbridge, T.C. Lethbridge. I mean, he did, as you know, he devoted a great deal of his time to investigating this. He was the master of the pendulum and all this kind of stuff. But there's a story back in 1914. Outbreak of the First World War, he was in chorister school in Durham, and one of the staircases was haunted by what was described as a very oppressive, invisible presence, which would stop people climbing it. It's a foreboding presence again, would stop people trying to climb the stairs. So a friend of him decided to investigate it, and he was probably about 13, 14 at the time. What they did is they went up the stairs. It was one of these very, very big, grand hallway stairs, you know, the ones where they sort of split off and then recombine, you know what I mean? Great big grand gallery ones. And him and his friend actually linked arms and walked up the stairs, and they felt that they were pushing this presence up and up and up and up. And eventually they got to the very, very top step, and they suddenly realized it was behind them. It had kind of rematerialized behind them. Basically, they pushed it back downstairs and then basically lost it where they first encountered it, which is halfway up the first flight.
Yeah.
It just kind of dissipated. And people carried on feeling this. And not long afterwards, there was an exorcism, because obviously, even though they'd been scoffed at by the head and stuff, they said, no, we're going to get this exorcised. And the whole place, far two rooms were exorcised. And one of the rooms, there was a bedroom adjacent to one of the unexorcised rooms. And he woke up feeling really full of dread and oppression.
Yeah.
And he dreamt that through the adjoining door to this room, a huge black hairy figure came out of it. And that's how he drowned. He woke, and that was it. And another exorcism followed. And the presence moved outside. And there was a passageway outside this particular room where people would fear it. But that's where it was. It was just confined to that area, and it never moved beyond that again. But that really struck me when I first read it, because I first read that years and years and years and years ago, long before I started getting interested in British Bigfoot. And I thought, my God, it's a big, big, black, hairy, oppressive thing. Mm. That's very familiar, you know, and that rings a bit of a bell. Mm. And then I started looking into it. I started sort of talking to people after that, and I made some good connections. I mean, I spoke to people who used to see them all the time. And a lot of the time there's these, I mean, I'll give you the example of Charmaine, who lives in Scotland. She's spoken quite a lot to the Edinburgh Fortune Society and so forth about this. And it was, she lived on a forested area, but it wasn't some primeval forest. It was a modern forestry commission planted forest.
Yeah.
Prior to that, it had been mining. It'd been open cast mining area. So it'd be fairly barren, actually.
Mm.
But one day she was playing in this cottage where she lived with her grandparents, fairly remote, and she spotted a big black shape pulling down a tree branch in the same way that you'd see, say, an orangutan pulling down a tree branch from the ground to sort of have a go at the leaves. That's what she saw. But she said there was no features. It was just big, solid and black.
Mm.
And she just didn't want to go near it. And then they used to hear things running past the house. Late at night. And her grandmother, who lived there all her life, would just say, don't worry, it's what she called the ginger roars. And that's what she called them. And she said, that's just them. They're just there. And she just completely accepted them. And her grandmother, and again, it's like the fae, it's a case that they're there. And in parts of Scotland, as you said, and in Ireland and in the Celtic regions generally, they just accept these things as being what they are.
Mm.
And leave them alone, they'll leave you alone. And that's basically the way her grandmother used to see it.
Yeah.
But again, it's the description that really, really fascinated me. It's this huge black figure. She said it was almost like it's so matte black that it just swallows light.
Yeah. Blacker than black.
Blacker than black, exactly. And and that ties in with what Lethbridge was saying about it absorbing energy, almost like a black hole. It's just pulling in all of the energy around it, sort of thing. It's almost like to manifest,
yeah.
Which is a very, very interesting thing, you know, and it's kind of, and again, the size, it's consistent. These things are always there. And then speaking later on, I was doing some more research, and I came across obviously the monks, and there was a lot of discussion about the monks generally. And M.J. Whalen, the author, started mentioning that there's a huge concentration of monk sightings in the Cotswolds, particularly, and especially around Northumberland. And the reason for this, he speculated, is because they were Roman areas.
Yeah.
And they were very, very Roman. I mean, the Cotswolds is on 20, 30 miles north of me, I suppose. And obviously Bath is really close to me. I've had a long time in Bath. And there's a good, very, very long tradition of black monk sightings, certainly in my part of the world.
Mm.
And there was a lot, in fact, there was a Roman villa two streets away from me that they excavated long ago. And there's a very big concentration of monk sightings, probably a mile or two on the other side of the river. So we've got a tradition of them as well. But again, they're big. They're not normal monks. They are big. They're huge. Mm. And they are black. And you don't see faces. You sometimes see red glowing eyes, but they're silent and they feel foreboding again. And this is how it starts to work out. Anyway, Whalen starts talking about the Romano-British carvings and records and stuff like that. And he mentions, his actual quote is, I'll read his actual quote. "I began to discover a possible answer when visiting the Housesteads Museum on Hadrian's Wall. As I entered the visitor centre, I was struck by a Romano-British relief showing three monk-type characters. The sign said they were the Genii Cucullati. I wanted to know who were the mysterious monk-like characters on the relief and how they related to the Romano-British." And he goes on to explain that this motif appears all over the place as well, including the Cotswolds and Northumbria. And basically, they look like ghostly monks.
Yes.
And so in the Middle Ages, anything you saw that was tall and dark with a pointy head was probably a monk.
Yes.
And this explains why you don't see him around churchyards, especially. You see him all over the flaming place. It's sort of like half the time when they saw the monks, they were nowhere near an abbey or nowhere near any sort of ecclesiastical building. But they assumed they were monks because monks used to go about, monks used to go on pilgrimages, monks used to go evangelizing and so forth. So they just assumed that they were a monk. And if they disappeared, then they were a ghost monk because there's obviously so many monks.
Yes.
So, on those lines. So, I mean, this is. Perhaps it's easy to conclude if it is a sacred site, albeit not a modern ecclesiastical one. But bear in mind how many churches are built on ancient sort of sacred sites.
Yes.
Yeah, an awful lot of them just supplanted them, didn't they?
Yeah.
And there's, in fact, our local church is built over the top of a former sacred Roman site. You know, it's all there. It's underneath it. But they're very open about it now. In the old days, they weren't. It was a case of, no, it's not, rubbish. But Lethbridge said, well, perhaps the sacred sites were there because they themselves were a source of fuel. Perhaps they were a very, very useful portal for, or indeed just a source of energy for the boggarts themselves. So perhaps it's the boggarts themselves, by whatever frame you want to call them, be it a god, be it a domestic god, be it whatever kind, that in fact that site, often with springs underneath them and stuff like that, running water does seem to play a part in it, were somehow fueling these visions. And as a result, people would then build the sacred site on that area because that's where they saw the boggart. It's not a case that the boggart appeared because they built the site. It's the other way around. Mm. It's where they'd seen it. Like the visions in Fatima, they built the complex around that because that's where they were seen. They weren't seen on an existing site. They built the site because that's where they were seen. And so Lethbridge's idea was, well, perhaps that's what's going on here. Mm. And what they're seeing are, in fact, genius, what the Romans called genii calculati.
Absolutely. Well, the thing with these guys as well is that people can't even agree on what their perceptions are in it. Because I know Roland Hutton is very keen to promote his idea that, well, he's not very keen. In his opinion, Hutton believes that these are some kind of fertility emblem, because a lot of these carvings, they seem to be carrying some kind of egg, as if they're sort of symbolizing life. Whereas I know, is it Graham Webster? He believes that they're some kind of sexual item and they're more phallic than anything else. And yet other people think that they're some kind of warrior cult because some of these carvings have swords and shields. So there's no... Even when we're talking about these strange carvings, and I've had the privilege of seeing a couple in the UK, that they are very striking, and they're clearly always in groups of three. So there's the three, as some people say, well, straight away, that's a red flag for the Trinity of whatever paranormal aspect you want to throw at that stew. Mm-hmm. So you've got that. So even so, we know that these are clearly very important in a certain period of time, but we still don't understand in which concept they were put forward for or why people had this reverence. And as you say about sacred sites, as you were explaining your point there, I was struck by probably one of the best examples of that I'm aware of in the north of England, which is Rudston, where you've got the tallest monolith in the UK. And literally 20 feet away is the church. So the church was built next to the monolith, which is, I think they dated the stone to around 2000 BC. So it's been there best part of 4,000 years. And it's one of those places that when you stand there and the stone is not local, it was, I think it came from Whitby.
Wow.
So they've dragged it miles to put it there.
Mm.
And even in the modern era, when I went to spend some time with Paul Sinclair last year, and we stopped there on the way back, Paul mentioned that one of his daughters was going out with somebody from Rudston.
Okay.
And on one particular night when she was in that village, because Rudston, literally, you could throw a tennis ball over the over the village. It's tiny, really. She was awoken by hooded figures in the bedroom of the house she was in.
Wow.
So once again, you have this connection with hooded figures appearing. And it opens up so many aspects of this because, as we've said a couple of times, you can have a theory and eventually you will come to a case or witnesses or an experience where it doesn't work anymore. It can't explain it away. So when we look at these sites, and obviously, whatever reason, the people that built the monolith felt that that area was special.
Hmm.
I mean, it's on a slight rise. If you look around, you can see for miles, and it's kind of surrounded by small hills. So you can see it coming. If you're making a pilgrimage there or you're coming to worship there, obviously it would have been quite striking when it was first there, because obviously it was just in the middle of this little sort of valley area without it being too extreme, Stu.
Yeah.
But it was clearly something that could be sighted from quite a while away, and it was obviously a very important area for people. Yep. And yet, we still have reports of people encountering these strange hooded figures.
Yeah, I know. It's amazing, isn't it? Funny enough, we were talking just before we went on air, weren't we, about the Gimp Man of Yatton, this is strange, because there is a history as well of there have been hooded figures seen in Yatton for many years. And Yatton, again, is a very small place. It's basically a load of farmland, a few houses with a railway line running through it. And if you remember, though, a couple of years ago, a guy said he was putting it into Bristol Temple Meads, because it's about 5-6 miles, I suppose, south of Bristol. He saw Bigfoot in a field.
Yes.
From the train.
Mm.
Now, this is literally half a mile from where this gimp bloke keeps on being sighted, and recently has been solitary within the last week or so has been sighted again in Yatton. Now, the description, of course, is he's not large, but he's a black shape.
Yeah.
You know, and so this guy might well have seen this bloke again in Yatton, but the problem is with Yatton, again, there have been, as I said, hooded figures described there in the past. It's had all manner of weirdness going on over the years, but above it, there have been loads and loads of UFO sightings over the years. Loads of them.
Yeah.
It's very close to Bristol Airport. And as a result, sometimes I think this actually gets in the way, because people just immediately assume things are planes. But it's quite often that the lights that people see start doing things that planes don't do.
Yeah.
The satellites don't do. They'll suddenly change course.
Yes.
Rapidly. I'm not sure how much they see. They used to be seen an awful lot. But there's a tradition of this in Bristol, that if you come in to Bristol on the M32, for example. I don't know if you've been down the M32 port.
Yeah.
Yes, you have. Right. Well, okay. You come towards there's an IKEA, isn't there? About halfway through. Now, before that, up on the hill, there's a yellow castle.
Yeah, right? There is. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Now, that used to be, at one point, it was a mental hospital.
Mm.
Prior to, a lovely yellow castle, a mental hospital. Fabulous. But prior to that, it's a stately folly. And there used to be a huge lake where the M32 is now, which they've resited. They've replanted it, called Duchess Lake. Now, there used to be loads and loads and loads of ghost sightings there, tons and tons and tons of them. And then suddenly, when they built, not far from that castle, there was a microwave tower, a post office, multi-rings, 1960s microwave tower there. Mm. It looks like the post office tower with a load of hoops around it. Can't miss it. You only see that thing. As soon as they built that, the ghost sightings stopped abruptly, all of them, which does tend to think, well, hang on, does this have something to do with electromagnetics? As soon as the ghost sightings stopped, the UFO sightings stopped it. People sighting UFOs instead, which is bizarre. To this day, they do. One of our best friends lives just the other side of the motorway up on the hill, and they see stuff all the damn time. And it's not planes, because obviously BAE used to be there, so you see planes coming in all the time. That the Avon and Somerset police helicopter is based near UWE, which is just the other side of it.
Yeah.
So there's lots and lots of air traffic around Bristol. There's tons of it. We're about half a dozen different flight paths and what have you. But as a result, you get used to what planes look like and what they do. You also get used to the idea of what satellites do. Mm-hmm. And they don't suddenly take a 90-degree bend. Yeah. That's something they don't do. They can't do it. You know, they just suddenly start going in another direction. That's weird. And this gets seen in Yatton quite a lot. And it's a very, very odd thing. Funnily enough, there used to be another mental hospital called Barrow, very, very close to Yatton, which had tons of paranormal stuff going. And that has long since shut, but the buildings are still there. Mm. And there's all kinds of weird reports come from there, including hooded figures. And the other thing is white ladies, which are the other things that you see alongside the black hooded figures. Quite often there is the white lady. It's also carved. It's also shown in relief. And the black dog. The three of them are sometimes seen together.
Yes.
Which is...
I was about to mention our good friend, the Shook.
Yeah, exactly. Now, Shook, I mean, in Somerset, which Yatton is in Somerset is not called the Black Shook. It's called the Girt Dog. Because that's how simplistic we tend to be. It's a bloody great dog, that Girt Dog, that. So it's called the Girt Dog. And there's loads of sightings of them around there as well. It's very close to, it's not that far from a place called Burrington Coombe, which is very similar to Cheddar Gorge. It's got that kind of topography to it.
Yeah.
And it's long got a history of things being seen, particularly black dogs. There's been lots of black dogs seen down that way. But they're the benevolent ones. They're the ones that will take a lone female traveller with her.
Yeah.
And get her to the inns and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But they won't, there's lots of streams, lots of tributaries, the River Yeo and stuff like that, and they won't cross it.
Yeah.
They will stop. And so, which again, you get the running water themes all starts to come through again. And obviously Somerset's riddled with running water. Mm. You know, half of it's drained. It's like the Fens almost. The Somerset levels, Glastonbury is absolutely riddled with little things. And people see stuff in Glastonbury all the damn time. It's become the tourist hotspot, obviously. But there is a load of weird shit happening in Glastonbury, even without the tourists. And it's a kind of like, it's an odd thing. But again, they've got a very big history of seeing black chains. And Glastonbury Abbey, if you've ever been there, is one of the most atmospheric places you can possibly go.
Yes.
And it's amazing. I mean, it's just, my older son has autism. I was talking about this before. And when he was very young, he was very, very hyperactive and very, very nervy. Very jumpy and didn't like any sort of stimulus. Taken to Glastonbury Abbey, and I'm not kidding, he would just go calm.
Mm.
And he'd just walk and very slowly and just take in the time. As soon as you left the Abbey compound, then you'd start kicking off again. And it's an amazing thing. And places can have this kind of influence. So again, I started thinking about why that might be. Energies, there's loads of underground springs underneath that. And also perhaps stone tape comes into it. But again, this comes into the blanket explanation thing. It could be 100 different things all manifesting similarly. And it could be that it's just us interpreting stuff in a certain way, depending on the cultural conditions at the time.
Yes.
So, yes, we could be seeing Genia Coccolati now and thinking, well, that's Bigfoot, because that's what we expect to see. Turn on Quest or Blaze, and 75% of the stuff, if it's not Americans wandering around with electronic devices shouting, it's a demon, then they're looking for Bigfoot. And then everybody's compared, you know, everybody thinks they're going to see Bigfoot if they're in the woods. And so they see a big black shape in the woods. It must be Bigfoot. It could be a load of other things. And this is the thing I've been trying to sort of say. I'm not actually saying I always think it's the Genius Cucullati, but I think the Genius Cucullati is actually in the mix.
Mm.
And, you know, and it could be ghosts of Bigfoot. It could be Bogart. It could be Genius Cucullati. It could be a dozen different things. But as we said before, it could just be that we just interpret all of these things similarly. Our brain interprets it that way.
Yeah.
Steve Jones gave me a very, very good example. There was a sighting of a Genius Cucullati. Somebody saw on a quite sacred site. And there's three people. One saw an upright hooded figure, one saw a black dog, and the third one saw nothing.
Mm.
So he said it could be that actually it's all the same stuff. It's just the way we're wired means we either pick it up or we don't. So, you know, but we got, you were saying about the sort of the physical, the single footprint and what have you, which is slightly risible, I must admit, particularly when it's in like your local municipal park, you tend to think, well, to be honest, it's next door to Asda. I think somebody would have spotted it if it was there, frankly, I'll be honest. But the big thing, of course, is the twigs, the branches and the structures. The structures, okay, I mean, well, we've spoken about structures before, particularly mm-hmm. a North American Bigfoot. Okay, yeah, all right, if you see a 50-foot large, deliberately uprooted and stuff like that, then that's quite something. However, if you're in a country park in the United Kingdom and you see a small sapling after a storm, which is leaning against another sapling, it's probably not a Bigfoot. That was probably a storm. That was the wind did that, in all probability. Mm. And also, if you had to find a little structure and it's about 3 foot high and it's like in a wigwam shape and there's basically a scout troop over the back, there's probably more like to be doing with the scouts than it is to do with Bigfoot.
Yeah, I think people have forgotten that for a lot of us growing up in the 70s and 80s, Stu, we used to go into the woods and build in dens. I've built a den out of sticks in the woods. If anybody stumbled across that in the modern era, they go, oh, well, what could have done this? A group of kids. That's what's done it.
Oh, totally. Totally. But this is the thing, they'll go, look at this. This is evidence. And it's kind of almost like a sport. I've tried to engage with some of the groups. Now, some of them, there's a lot of Bigfoot groups on Facebook. There's hundreds of them. As you know, most of them are US-centric. But there's quite a few of the British ones as well. And these vary. Some of them are very, very open-minded. And they're looking for an answer. Like us, they are absolutely acknowledging that people are seeing something and they want to get to the truth of what it is they're seeing, which is brilliant. This is where most of us are coming from. Some of them, however, are absolutely convinced that it's a flesh and blood Bigfoot. And they will pick up anything as evidence. I saw one not long ago. It was a photograph of a load of sticks on the ground next to a track, which was obviously a farm track. You know, the tractors have been up and down it. And it was sticks on the ground. Oh, this is evidence. It's not evidence. It's evidence that tractor's driven past a bloody tree.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's not evidence of a Bigfoot.
I think the aspect of this, because often people will find my opinion quite surprising about a lot of things, that when I talk about these subjects, Stu, I am very skeptical about a lot of it. And I think when you're just accepting anything, then you're in trouble. And there are several aspects of all this in regards to some of these groups that a lot of them have next to no knowledge of British mammals, because I have heard fox calls put forward as Bigfoot cries somewhere in the UK, badgers, even a cow mooing, I think, was one. And I'm astounded, despite the fact I live in a major city, I go out all over the place. I'm very lucky that, yes, I live in a major city. I'm living probably the greenest major city, but where I grew up, I was surrounded by farmland.
Yeah,
I've heard foxes all over the place. I've been to friends in areas down south where every night you can set your watch by the time the foxes turn up.
Yeah,
I've got friends who own farms in Derbyshire. I've heard badgers making very strange noises.
Yes.
One of my friends was once cornered by a very angry badger, which wasn't a pleasant experience for them. And they had to basically pole vault over a fence to get away from this thing, because he was going to have her ankles. I think it's a combination of things added to the deeply cynical aspect of this, that once again, you have people who are promoting this idea on YouTube to an audience that, as I referred to earlier, with the best of intentions, know next to nothing about flora and fauna of the British Isles.
No. It's not just that. In many cases, they have a need to believe. And I mean, in one or two cases, they've actually developed an entirely evidence-less backstory for it. They've built a whole mythology around it. Now, they've seen something. I do not doubt for one second they've seen something. But then others, they built it up to such a incredible degree. I mean, it does mirror the kind of the deep, deep conspiracy laden UFO phenomenon in the US, you know, where it got so laden with just this, based on literally one thing. So we've seen a light in the sky. Before you know, there's an entire mythology based around it. And what we've seen here, now this is my personal experience of this, is you go into these groups and they sort of, you read some of the things and you think, okay, no, that's an interesting thing. But as soon as you start speaking to them, they'll start launching into what it is and how this is happening. And one of the most extreme one I've seen is one that's they talk a bit, the manifestations of the black ape. And the black ape is supposed to be some sort of wrathful deity, which is coming to for judgment on mankind. I'm not kidding you. And as soon as you start questioning this, then they immediately, genuinely, will accuse you of being a member of MI5 who are trying to shut them up and spying on them. And I actually said that, and I've screenshotted all of this. It's going to come quite soon as an article. I screenshot it and I'll verbatim sort of like post it. And basically, I said, well, no, this is me. Look, I'll show you. I write for the FT, and this is, you were talking about Patterson Gimlin earlier on. Look, this is the article I did about it. Read that. See, I'm not some debunker or anything like that. And literally, they just came back with, well, the Fortune Times is run by GCHQ. It's like, for the name of God, really? And they just, and I got banned after that. They banned me straight away.
Yes.
Because I was an agent of disinformation because I didn't agree with every single word they said.
Yes. Before I started all this, Stu, I'd been, other than reading the Fortune Times, I'd been completely out of the loop for about 5 or 6 years. So when I stumbled across this whole British Bigfoot thing, I was absolutely nonplussed. And I made a post, I think it was on the Fortune Times board.
Mm.
And then the next thing I knew, I was getting direct messages from people of a certain British Bigfoot organization.
Yes.
Accusing me of all kinds of stuff. They tried to get my Facebook closed down, claiming that I was somebody else who's also a very well-known member of the Fortune Times message board, claiming that I was an agent of disinformation.
Yeah.
I was working for MI5.
Yeah.
I was a debunker. I was a skeptic. And I just thought, if all you can do is just try and shut people down who have the temerity just to ask you some simple questions, then you're on shaky ground. Now, I have the misfortune of having some experience with a cult here in Sheffield, which is quite notorious in the 90s.
Okay.
And a few of my friends and acquaintances ended up getting caught up in some kind of cool Christian cult that was being run out of a church in Sheffield in the 90s.
Okay.
Which was known as the 9 o'clock service, which was essentially a young hip vicar trying to get kids into Christianity. That wasn't what he was doing. Anyway, I'll just say Google it, because I don't want to give this person any more publicity. And thankfully, he felt the wrath of the law, as so he should. But
Good. It
was very interesting that even after it came out, some people who had been deeply into it considered it all to be a setup. He'd upset people. It's always them. He'd upset them. As always, as you say about ufology or cryptozoology, there are certain people who will always believe that any disproving of any idea, you're one of them.
Yeah.
You work for them. They are. They're here. Whoever they are. And then you start to think, well, what on earth? Who are they? Who are these people? Where do these shadowy people live? And it seems as though it's come across from ufology of Kiel's era.
Yes.
And the Men in Black to now permeate into all other aspects of it. I've even seen it mentioned occasionally in paranormal research, people are dealing with hauntings, Stu, where people are claiming that if you disprove things, then you're one of them.
Yeah.
There they are. And yet you have to question it. When you can't deal with criticism, be it constructive or even, as with anything, if you have a genuine interest in a subject and you are someone who is a gatekeeper of information, a question, and all they do is shut you down, then they don't want questions. They only want adoration in whatever form it may take, be it you sharing their post or joining their group or saying, oh, this is amazing. This is incredible. Yeah. I can't believe you've been able to research this.
Yeah.
That's not research. That's akin to a cult, because you're all in and what you say goes and nobody can question it. And you still see it all the time, even in ufology, it still permeates and it pulls everything to pieces, Stu. And I think when you look at this aspect, that what else is going on here? Because as I mentioned earlier, Paul Sinclair, obviously Paul at the moment is finishing off his documentary Wolflands.
Yes.
Now, once again, we have people who are seeing something that isn't supposed to exist, with the greatest respect. And once again, Paul has tried to be as matter of fact about this. And when he's spoken about it, I've heard him interviewed on several other shows, and people will always try and push him down one particular avenue.
Yeah.
And he won't go down that avenue, because, as he says, he doesn't believe that bipedal wolfmen are running around the north of England. Nope. He thinks they're something else. And I think, as you were saying about the experience that Steve Jones shared with you about three people having a sighting and they all had very different interpretations of what had happened.
Yeah.
I've always found those aspects in regards to a ghost sighting very interesting, that some people will see something and everybody else won't. Or why, when certain people visit certain haunted locations, Stu, nothing happens, but somebody else goes on a certain day at a certain time and they see something.
Yes.
And it's a very similar thing. And I think, as we've been talking about trying to pigeonhole, people trying to pigeonhole whatever's going on here with this phenomenon across the UK, Paul has been very careful to kind of tiptoe around being pigeonholed with this, because he says, I don't know what they're seeing, but they're seeing something.
Exactly my attitude, yeah. You know, it's happening. This is part of the problem. I think if any of us went in and just went, oh, bollocks, it's not happening, then they'd have a grudge. And I could kind of understand that. But when you go in from the start and say, look, I'm interested, I want to hear about this, unless you swallow the whole lot. I thought for a while, I make the comparison with what I call the burghers of Ghent.
Yeah.
Right. So you think about this all like the 14th century theocratic rulers of Belgian citadels, and you have no idea what's going to set them off next. You can say anything. And so they've told people quite literally who historically, as we all know, actually, for example, put pigs to death for blasphemy.
Yeah.
You know, and stuff like that, because the cognitive dissonance is such that anybody who says anything that contradicts anything they believe must be a liar or an agent of disinformation or demonic.
Yeah.
Or the modern thing being a member of the security services or an agent of disinformation, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And this is it. And it's much, much easier for them to believe their own version of reality than it is for them to be faced with anything that contradicts it.
Yeah, absolutely. You can see parallels in what was going on with the witch trials and everybody. 400 years ago, you did anything that wasn't the norm or the expectation. Yeah. You were a witch.
Yeah, this is a self-verifying thing as well, because they were a witch because they were doing something unusual. They've been executed because they were a witch.
Yeah.
Why were they executed? Because they were a witch. Why? Because they did this thing that was unusual. And it's just this, and it's a circular thing. Mm. And unfortunately, you can't break that kind of circle. And you see these things. I mean, one of the screenshots I've got is a guy he's one of the Bigfoot groups to which I've now been banned, obviously. I've been chucked out a lot of them. I get chucked out of Facebook groups all the time. They have to be paranormal ones. It's just a hobby of mine.
Mm. Anyway,
you know that. Anyway,
yes.
What he was doing, he was taking scientific journals and he was taking reports of long extinct megafauna and stuff like that and crudely altering the title so much so you could see it. It'd be photoshopped.
Yeah.
To imply that these things were happening now. And then as soon as you challenge that, then the whole lot will descend on you. How dare you doubt it? It's like, well, look, here's the original. You know, I'm citing, here's the snapshot of the original sort of like headline. And it'd be like, no, you've altered that. Or you're an agent of disinformation, you've had it changed. It's, but for the name of God, you know, whatever you do, you can't win with them.
Yeah.
You know, you cannot. And after a while, I did kind of stop doing it for the simple reason you will not. You can't argue. To quote a good friend of mine, you can't argue with a nutter. And that's it, because they make their own reality. Their own reality is whatever they make it.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, arguing against their reality is just pointless.
Absolutely.
You know? Absolutely. And that's it.
Well, I've learned a lot about Bigfoot over the last 5 years, Stu.
Mm,
a lot of it I didn't want to know.
Mm.
And a lot of it is just palpable nonsense, but people believe it. I mean,
Yes. We've
got recordings of people who are clearly pretending, shouting out of windows and saying that they can talk and they're psychically predicting things, and you've got these going on. I suppose in a way, people have always had to believe in some kind of thing, and it's very interesting that there are some people out there that are gravitating towards this kind of cryptozoological aspect of it, where perhaps 100 years ago, you know, we had people in Ireland who believed that babies were being stolen by the Fae and the whole changeling thing. And people think, oh, well, that's years and years and years ago. But there's several famous cases and very tragic cases of changelings that are terrifyingly recent.
Yes.
You know, we even had, I was talking to John LeMay recently because I wasn't aware of anything that had happened after the Trail of Tears, but there was a whole Navajo witch trial scandal that blew up where I think over 40 people were accused and put to death for being witches in the 1870s.
Good God.
So we're talking 150 years ago. yeah. and everything else. And obviously America was embracing the modern era and having a rapid expansion across the place. And you'd still got this pocket of old fashioned superstition where people who had done nothing else but be able to grow crops were being accused of being magic because their next door neighbor's crops wouldn't grow and therefore they must have been cursed. And
yes.
And as such, they were a witch. They were killed. Yep. And it's one of those things we see it even into the modern era. We only have to look at what happened with the Tutsis in Africa the last 30 years, Stu. Yep. Similar things. And we still get stories coming out of certain parts of the world where people are accused of witchcraft and witchery and all kinds of horrible things. And awful things happen because of it. And it's remarkable that even in this modern age where we've got all the information in the world at our fingertips and entertainment endlessly streaming on all kinds of platforms, there are still pockets of the world that seem to be locked into this constant battle with reality and the belief that every part of evidence and science and information and knowledge is nonsense. It's all a conspiracy to stop them believing the truth.
Yes, yes, exactly. It's funny. I've written an article about this, as you know, which is going to be in the September issue 221, I think. It's going to be there, probably the next issue of the FT. But I'll conclude in the end that we actually do, I think as a race, we do still need the wild man.
Yes.
We do need it. It's an essential part of us, I think. I mean, it's like this all the portrait in Dorian Gray's Attic in a way. And we need, in the old days, it appears so much in churches because it was a reminder that we've risen above the beasts and that we have, we are a part, but there's a part of us which is to acknowledge that part of us is wild. And that's what the Green Man is. And I think probably what the wood was is, to be honest, is probably just a representation of man, not civilized and stuff like that. But I made the point in the conclusion of my thingy that we Bigfoot is kind of our collective psyche now in a way, and that we need it really. It's like look at the example in Forbidden Planet, which I know you love because that's your kind of thing. In Forbidden Planet, the monster turns out to be Morbius's id all the time.
Yes.
It's his own subconscious, trying to fight against him, and that's based on the Tempest. And and the point is, at the end of everything, Prospero, the greatest magician in the world ever, the greatest sorcerer, in the end, it's still Caliban, the wild man, who gets the island.
Mm.
He ends up as the king. And it's nature wins every single time. And I think this is an important thing. We do need nature to taunt us occasionally and just remind us, it's got much more power than we've got.
Absolutely. And I think as well, the other aspect of everything else that we've been speaking about, there is one particular location in the UK which essentially proves the point that one explanation doesn't fit it, because what's been going on at Ben MacDur
all
these years? So as we've been saying about people having very different experiences from the same thing, Ben MacDur some people aren't aware of it. It's the second tallest mountain in Britain by something like, is it something like 37 metres short as a Ben?
For a long time, it was thought to be the biggest, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Nevis was only proved, I think it's only the 20th century that they realised actually Nevis was here. Yeah.
And we've got this whole catalogue going back the best part of a century where very experienced and well-known mountaineers, day trippers, irregular climbers, people, tourists, whatever, have had very unusual occurrences when they've been there.
Yeah.
But some people say that they see a tall, hairy man.
Yeah.
And other people claim that they don't see anything, but it's a brooding presence and they can hear heavy footsteps. So we've once again got a dark shape and a ghost.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I've seen it explained away as a Brocken Spectre several times and what have you, but Brocken Spectres don't make heavy footsteps.
No.
They don't give you a sense of foreboding. They give you a sense of shock when you come around the hillside and there the thing is, but they don't. And there's one similar in Dom Dartmoor as well. Of course, you get the famous hairy hands, which grab the steering wheel and stuff like that. But that whole area, there's been sightings of something big and oppressive looking in amongst the rocks and black dogs, which is where Conan Doyle got the Hand of the Baskervilles from.
Yeah.
Because there's a long version of that. But again, that could be the same bloody thing just seen by different people. It could be the same presence all round, just manifesting in different ways. Because you're in a very, very tight area. And again, you get these triangles, as you said, like Bempton, like and again, like Yatton is the same sort of thing, Glastonbury, these kind of places where it's all concentrated, but simply possibly because it the sites or the conditions there are good enough that it's apparent to more people. Mm. It could be the stuff's happening all over the place, but it's a lot weaker in certain areas, like a phone signal. Mm. You know, suddenly you'll hit it and it's a lot more people can get it. But I don't know. It's interesting stuff. But I think what I want to do ultimately is say, look, this is a huge picture. And I think there's a lot of common factors. And I think it's first of all important to acknowledge that this stuff is happening. Mm. People are seeing it. Totally sober. Right-minded people, they see this stuff. And like with all Bigfoot and ghost and UFO reports, they quite often risk ridicule and stuff like that. They're not going to gain anything from it. Gone are the days when you get $1 million out of seeing a UFO.
Yeah.
You know, that's not been happening since the 50s. Ain't going to happen anymore. There's certain people who, okay, fine, Whitney Strieber, discuss. But, you know, but then the guy was already a sci-fi writer anyway.
And a very successful one.
And a very successful one. So it's kind of that, it's that double jeopardy, isn't it? Did he write Chameleon because he knew it'd be successful? Did he write Chameleon to tell the truth? You know, it's a different thing. Interestingly, Christopher Walken said when he met him, he was totally sincere. He said he absolutely believes, he said he thinks it happened to him. Put it that way. You know, it's an interesting thing. But anyway, we talked about Chameleon before, I know. But I think, again, this stuff is happening and people are risking ridicule by reporting it. And I think it's, in a way, we almost owe them to investigate it and to come up with possible suggestions. And it's something we see on the FT board all the time. There's two types when we do the happen to me stuff. Quite often what you'll see is people come on there and say, this is happening. And what you'll get is two types of response, because we will then, because we've done this for 20 years now on that board, we'll go, okay, fine, all right. Have you thought about this, this, and this? Simply to eliminate the stuff that we know it might be.
Yeah.
Quite often you'll get people going, oh, okay, I'll think about that. Yeah, it could be this. It could be this. Oh, no, it's definitely not that.
Mm.
And they go through that. Other people just go, how dare you disbelieve me, you skeptical bastards? And they just, that's it. I disappear in a minute of, you know, just, unfortunately, fortune is by nature soft skeptic, because it has to be. We're not credulous. There's a difference between credulity and fortunism. We're not credulous.
Absolutely.
We see this stuff all the time.
Mm.
Yeah. Damn data. We're reporting what's been said. It doesn't mean we believe it.
Mm.
And that's the thing. And it's kind of, and I want to find an explanation. I don't think it's a blanket explanation. I don't want a blanket explanation, but I do want to piece together all the bits of the puzzle and see how they all kind of fit together.
Yeah, absolutely.
And this is something that's happening a lot and people are seeing it. And I think this is a sort of cogent thing. And I'm still coming back more and more to the idea that there are energies that we all interpret differently in different ways and have different effects on us. And it's not saying it's the same stuff, but perhaps there is, perhaps this is what Ron Moorhead means. Perhaps dimensionally, he is actually onto something. Maybe the Bigfoot he's seeing isn't actually Bigfoot, but it's the way that he interprets whatever the vortex it is he's encountering.
Yeah, but it can apply to all kinds of things. And as you were saying there about the skeptical explanations, one of the things that always gets my goat is when people explain away the Hat Man or the Shadow Man as sleep paralysis. Primarily, Stu.
Yeah.
Because if it is sleep paralysis, why are people seeing old-fashioned dressed people then?
Yeah.
Why are they wearing hats of an old type? Surely, as I've said to a couple of people about this, if people were seeing the Hat Man wearing a baseball cap, then you would begin to think, well, that's clearly something working in your brain and it's trying to work out. And yet we have people who have probably no exposure to this kind of style of hat claiming to see these things, and people go, oh, well, it's just sleep paralysis. Now, I've had sleep paralysis. It's only happened to me once, but I didn't see anything. It was terrifying until I realized what was going on.
Yes, it is, isn't it? I've had it once, yeah.
It's very odd. It's like you just burst. It's like you're in a bubble and you just burst out of it. It's very strange.
It's like you're drowning almost, isn't it? It's really, really, freaked me out like hell. Because I was awake and I've got locked in, you know. Horrible.
And it was first thing in the morning. Well, not first thing in the morning, it was morning. So it was bright and it was sunny.
Yeah.
And it was just a very strange thing. Mm. So when I hear a skeptical explanation, once again, that just goes into that, it's like one of my other favorite subjects, spontaneous human combustion. And people say, well, they were all overweight, alcoholic smokers.
Yeah.
Okay. I know, I've grown up in Yorkshire. I've run pubs. Yeah. I've met many people like that. None of them. Yeah. Burst into flames for no reason. And it's one of those as well, because if you know anything about fire, when it comes to spontaneous human combustion, fire doesn't work like that.
No, it doesn't. Exactly. It's they come up with all kinds of different ways. Paul Hamer did it ages and ages and ages back, did the forensic pathologist. And he tried to sort of prove the wick effect. And in the end, he effectively had to wrap up a body in lard and wrap it in several blankets and take a blowtorch to it, and then it kind of worked. But he's kind of, really?
it also set fire to the entire set.
It did, yes.
And they had to call the fire brigade in to put it out, which, exactly. I think, once again, is not what happens in spontaneous combustion.
But again, this has come back down to forced time data, doesn't it? The fact this stuff happens. And sometimes it might be that somebody's clothing caught fire. Mm. But these days, clothes are less likely to catch fire than they used to be. In the 50s, it did used to happen. Quite often, people were in new synthetic fibres, and obviously in nightclubs, dance halls, people used to smoke all the damn time. Mm. And literally, if you brushed against a cigarette end, something could go up. That used to happen a lot. But it's not spontaneous human combustion. That's just fire risk. You know what I mean? It's a different thing.
Yeah.
And there's a famous one. Oh, this woman caught fire in a dance hall. Used to happen all the damn time. You know, that was just synthetic fibres and fag ends.
Yeah.
You know, that's just that one, her internally catching fire. Mm-hmm. That was her petticoat going up. That was, you know, it's a. But yes, it's you're right. It's a case quite often of finding separating the wheat from the chaff, because things can, incredibly weird things can happen to people which are totally mundane, mm-hmm. but they appear bloody weird. You know, I've seen things from an odd angle and thought, what the hell's that? And then you're right, okay. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's very strange. We do it. I think we forget we've done it a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. But I've seen stuff and thought, that is bizarre.
Yeah.
From where I'm sitting now, I can see right over the hills and stuff like that into South Gloucestershire. So like towards Bath and stuff like that, and over towards the Cotswolds. And I can see it all from here. And quite often I'll see stuff. I will see a hovering light in the sky. What it is actually a plane coming towards me,
mm.
because we're on one of those slide paths. So you see this pinpoint of light, and it's not doing anything if it has a hovering light. It's not hovering. It's just because the angle I'm looking at, that's all it is. It's a bloody plane. It's going to land in the airport in a minute, which is 5 miles in that direction.
Yep.
Hovering over the gimp bloke in Yatton. You know, it's going to, that's what it is. but it can catch anybody out. And even people like ourselves who are used to this kind of stuff and are very good, we know we're armed with all the possibilities. They can still catch us out, you know.
Yeah. I was talking yesterday on a UFO board, and we were discussing, somebody had put some sightings that were clearly balloons from a birthday party that had escaped.
Yeah.
And it reminded me that about 10 years ago, I think it was a Sunday afternoon, summer's day, Stu.
Yeah.
And I was just in my front room, just munching about, and something caught my eye in the sky.
Hmm.
And it was this strange rotating shape that looked really odd. And I thought, what the hell is that? Because obviously I see one particularly weird thing in the sky that to this day I know what I didn't see, but I can't tell you what it was. And I was like, surely I can't be seeing something else strange in the sky. So I went outside.
Yeah.
And I was like, what the hell is that? And it took me about 30 seconds to a minute for my eyes to focus and gauge the distance. And I suddenly realized it was a collection of balloons that were all tied together.
Right, yeah.
That had clearly broken free from a fair or a party or something, that were floating, I don't know, 1,000 feet up in the air.
Mm.
At first glance, I have no idea what it was. And it was only because I took the time to study it, because I'm odd.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I thought, I wonder what the hell that is. And to be fair, I was very disappointed. But then again, I was thinking, my goodness, that's probably the biggest collection of balloons I've ever seen that's escaped.
Yeah.
So even that's strange.
Yeah.
It shows you that unless you take the time or you get a proper look at something, you will always misunderstand a fleeting glimpse of something, whatever it might be.
You will. This is true. From my own memory, I've been remembering this. You think of somebody and the phone goes into that kind of thing, which is happened to all of us.
Mm.
You know, and I know statistically it's likely to happen, all that kind of stuff, this cluster effect, some la 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 la. But I have this thing where sometimes, and this happens to me a lot for some reason, I'm in town or something and I'll spot a glimpse of somebody, I think it's somebody I know. And it's not. It's not there. Look again. No, it's not them at all. But then the person I thought it was will come around the corner.
Yeah.
And that happens to me a lot for some reason. I think I see that. It's almost as a foreshadowing.
Mm.
I don't necessarily expect to see them in town, you know. I don't know about the centre of Sheffield, but on the centre of Bristol now, people don't tend to go there so much. Everything's gone out of town.
Mm.
You know, people only tend to come into town for certain specific things. So it's not like they're going to be there every day.
Mm.
Whereas I work relatively centrally, so I spend quite a lot of time. But these people don't. They've got no reason really to be there.
Yeah.
But yeah, so, but it happened to me just literally the other day. I spotted someone. Oh, it's a friend of mine. And then she turned around. It wasn't her, but from the fact that exactly, you know,
yeah.
Yeah, we can, quite often you can't, they always say, don't they? You can't disguise the back of someone's head. That's always a difficult thing to disguise. And it looks exactly like a friend of mine, the back of her head. And she turned around, it wasn't her at all. It's like, okay, fine. And then literally my friend walked out of Marks and Spencer's. He's like, bloody hell. You know, and but I've started collecting those, and these are happening a lot. And I just want to see if that's a frequent thing with other people. Because the phone thing's one thing, but in person, you know, there are other energies at work and stuff like that we kind of know. Is there a kind of antenna that you tend to know when someone who's close to you is around?
Yes. It's one of those weird things, no. I think, often. I mean, I can think of two or three examples where I've been somewhere and I've bumped into somebody either that I knew or was from where I was from.
Yeah.
One of them was, I went to see Oasis at Nebworth.
Uh-huh.
And we walked in. There's 125,000 people there, Stu. I walked in. We got in. We went to the bar. We got a drink. We were having a look, just turning around, and somebody went, hello, Paul. And I turned around, and it was a guy I hadn't seen for 5 years who grew up round the corner from where my mum lived.
Bloody hell.
Who was also called Paul.
Hey. Yeah.
I went to Tenerife in November 97.
Yeah.
2 days there. I'm stood walking down the beach and somebody went, hey, Paul.
Wow.
Once again, somebody I'd not seen for several years. And the strangest one that ever happened, I went to Italy. My friend won a golf trip, all expenses paid, and we went to Venice. On the first day we got there, jumped on a train because we were stopping about 50 miles outside of Venice. And we thought, we're here. We've got Monday clear. Let's go to Venice. So we got off at the train station. We walked all the way down to the big square. And it was a beautiful day, late 20s, really lovely weather, nice and dry. Went, should we go in this bar, get a drink? Went there, sat down, started talking, and there was this old couple sat there. And this lady went, I'm terribly sorry to bother you. Are you from Sheffield? I said, yes, I am. She said, we've just got off the cruise. We're here for an hour. And they decided to sit at the next table to where we were.
Wow.
Just by chance. Now, that's a bit odd. Regardless, that is weird. To be in a foreign country 1,000 miles away, that you want somebody, and she lived about 6 miles from where I live.
Wow.
She lives at the top of Sheffield. And it was very odd that even in the middle of Italy, you would bump into somebody like that. And I think often we just kind of think, oh, that's a bit strange.
Yeah, you do. It's right. I used to work with a guy and we worked together for about 3 or 4 years, I suppose, but when I was in Ed. We just chatted about where we came from. So we all lived in South Bristol, Embry, so, but we, you know, okay, so whereabouts do you live? And he said, oh, I lived on such and such a road. That's two streets away from me. And he's the same age as me, right? Now, I went to a different school simply because my parents lived. Yeah, my parents were at the other side of the city.
Yeah.
So it was easier for them to sort of take me to school close to where they worked, rather than have hair across the town, you know what I mean? That kind of thing. So I actually went to school probably six, seven miles from where we lived. But as a result, I didn't go to school with him. But we lived two streets away from him. We used to play in the same park, used to go to the same swimming pool, used to go hang around the same shopping precinct, never twigged us each other. And then suddenly, we said, really? Yeah, I used to do this. Do you know so-and-so? Yeah. And we knew people in common. We, you know, all this kind of stuff, but he and I had never encountered each other, despite the fact we lived 300 yards from one another for all of, well, right up until sort of late teenage.
Yeah.
And it's bizarre.
Yeah.
It's utterly bizarre.
Yeah.
But, you know, it is strange. But then again, you get the other thing, well, with somebody, as I said, that you know, and I've got one friend, I just bump into her all the damn time. And it's just constant. We don't live anywhere near each other.
Yeah.
We just, and it's also, we kind of expect it. If a week goes by and I don't bump into her, I think, oh no, this is weird. We don't work anywhere near each other, anything like that. We just bump into each other all the damn time. It's a very strange thing, isn't it? It's kind of like, it's almost like this, as I said, it's like you have an air, it's almost like you have an antenna for where people are around that you know well, and you've got a certain harmony with, or certain sort of like syncopacity with, that you kind of know where, you know what I mean? It's kind of, you were aware where they're there.
Yeah. I once had an occasion, Stu, where I went to London to meet up with some friends. I've got a few friends who live down there. One of them's a journalist who works for The Guardian football.
Okay.
And we once went out for a drink, and he said, oh, one of my mates has come in. So I met this kid, and we both, as soon as we saw each other, we were both struck that we knew each other, but we didn't know how.
Ah, okay.
But we knew each other well enough to know which team we supported and also what our favourite bands were. So we'd clearly spoken.
Yeah.
You know, this is 20-odd years ago, so it's before social media, so there was no way you could have garnered that information. And we were both nonplussed. We couldn't work out how we knew each other. But we'd clearly met at some point in our lives, but we couldn't remember where.
Wow. That's amazing, isn't it? It is. I've come across that. I was a doorman, not a club for a while, for quite a long time in my early 20s. And so I used to see a lot of people. You know, they recognized me. I used to say to people, well, you know, there's hundreds of you, there's only one of me.
Yes.
I used to say when people come up to me and go, you used to teach me. And yeah, I probably did 20 years ago, but then you're now in your mid late 30s and you've got a family. You've changed a lot more than I have. You know, I look like this, albeit thinner and less bald, but it was still obviously me, you know.
Yeah.
People change a lot between the ages of 17 and 37. They change a bloody sight more than I have, you know. So it's kind of, you know, it's a, please forgive me, but some people you just twig me there. Oh, my God, it's you, you know, and it's a weird thing, isn't it? And this, again, comes back to the, bringing it back to what we're talking about generally. I think the human body has an immense array of senses that we just don't use.
Yeah.
And it's not that they're extrasensory perception or anything like that at all. They're completely natural ones. It's just we've stopped using them because we've got phones and we got telly and we got communities and we live next door to people now. But probably, you know, it'd be useful perhaps or interesting if they could examine people who do still live a relatively sort of nomadic lifestyle to see and don't have the modern stuff, to see if actually they're more aware, they have these perceptions more than we do. Because, I mean, certainly I know, having watched, say, a cat with a litter of kittens, the cat knows where all the kittens are, even if they're all in completely different directions and hiding. The cat knows exactly where every one of them is. And I think parents, as a parent, you do have a sense of where your kid is, which is why it's such an unholy terror if one of them goes missing.
Yeah.
Because you suddenly don't know where they are. You know, you don't have that sense. That sense has gone of where they are. And that is a very, very frightening thing to happen to anybody. And it's kind of, it's, and I think perhaps this is just, all of these things are just something that we are kind of, it's not that they're dormant in us. It's not a sad case we've lost them. It's just we don't bloody use them.
Yes.
You know, and we just don't think of it. And it suddenly, it'd be nice to see, it'd be interesting to see whether or not, given some training or just given the opportunity, we could rehone these things. And then perhaps we would start seeing more of these things. And actually, I think that they're natural. It's just, they're weird. Of course, they're weird, but that's because we don't understand them.
Yeah.
You know, I think once we understand what's going on there, then it'll lose all the mystique. It'll lose an awful lot of the skepticism. And then once this bit's sorted, perhaps we can then start looking for flesh and blood things that might be in the Pacific Northwest. And I hope they are. And I hope they're in the Caucasus. But get this bit out of the way first. Solve little mysteries as we're going along. You know, once we understand more of this, perhaps we'll understand more of that. And that's my overall thing, I think.
And I think we just have to, as a final point, Stu, we have to realise that at the end of the day, we know next to nothing about how the brain works, regardless of modern science and technology, and anybody that says, oh, well, it can't possibly be that. There's no basis in that.
No, there's not at all. The thing is, I mean, because obviously, as people know, we have I talk a lot about neurodivergence, and I've got ADHD, and I've had it since, you know, I was diagnosed at the age of 3. So I've had 52 years to get used to it. A lot of people get diagnosed in later life. But then again, I also understand what's going on with people to a degree with autism. My son has autism.
Yeah.
So I mean, it's, and I work with a lot of people with neurodivergences of various kinds. And the thing is that the human brain and the human nervous system is as much a filter as it is an antenna.
Yep.
So it picks up stuff, but it also then automatically filters it. And that's where you get the dinner party thing, or rather the party effect. You know, you're sat at one end of a very big room, people chatting. Somebody says your name on the far side of the room, you'll hear it. You know, you filter out everything until you hear your name click, then you go into that. Now, people with autism can't do that. They can't filter it. So they're hearing all the conversations.
Yeah.
And it overwhelms them.
Yeah.
And as a result, they have to narrow it down and just focus on the one thing and kind of like, you know, like that. ADHD, on the other hand, which is what I've got, We also hear all of it, but we can process all of it. However, that's at the expense of being able to focus on the single thing. Yeah. So we got the opposite problem. What's interesting is a lot of people who are on the edge, because quite a lot of people got ASD and ADHD, can flip between the two. And as a result, they have ADHD and they're all like me, they're all squirrel and going off on tangents and running about, but then they can focus. They can snap into the ASD bit of it and focus fiercely on something. I can do that a little bit. There's probably a little bit of autism in me, but it means I can write a bloody great article in the space of a day. I can do that, but I've got to have done all the squirreling and running about and formulating my brain first of all. But equally, a lot of people with autism can then go ADHD and they can harness it. And a good example of that is Stephen Wiltshire, the guy who can look at a landscape for 10 minutes and then write in perfect detail. That's an ADHD trait. That's not an autism one. That's an ADHD trait because you can see, you can take in everything.
Yeah. Remarkable.
And then focus it. So yeah, you get people who flip, but I think we're just extreme examples of what the human body can do.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the human brain, the nervous system can do it. It can pick up all kinds of stuff. There's people who can see into the infrared. People who can see into ultraviolet.
People can see sounds.
Yeah, yeah, totally. Yeah, I know a couple of people got synesthesia, you know, and a good friend of mine can hear colors.
Yeah.
Literally. But she can't explain how it is because it's so alien to us.
Yeah.
But she can hear colors.
Yeah.
You know, she can feel stuff and it's very strange, but it's what she's used to. And but I think a lot of this stuff that we're seeing and people are seeing is simply bits of our brain trying to come through that we've largely forgotten about, you know?
Well, as always, Stu, a thoroughly thought-provoking and divergent conversation that's taken us all over the place, as usual, my friend.
Oh, I could ramble the best of them, mate. Don't you worry. One day I'll stick to a subject. I promise you, we'll do 2 hours and I'll stick to it. No, I won't. You know, that's bollocks. I won't do that for a second.
Yeah. Sometimes there's nothing wrong with taking a scattergun approach to strange phenomena in the best of circumstances, Stu. So,
this is true.
Where can everybody keep up to date and join the Fortean Towers message boards and also keep up to date with your latest articles and when they're due out?
I'm the TV critic now for the FT, and I've been for over a year. So I get to make fun of things monthly. Me and Peter Laws share a page. the Reverend, and he writes about weird horror films, which is your kind of thing.
Yeah.
And then I poke fun at Paranormal Witness, things like that, which is great fun. We work quite sympathetically in that respect. But yeah, other than that, it's not the Fortean Times message board. It is the Fortean Forums. We are under the CFI, so we're under the Charles Fort Institute.
Yeah,
but we, you know, obviously we still maintain a cordial relationship with the Fortean Times. So keep up with me. I've got more articles coming up. I'm writing more and more for the FT now. So as I said, my next one, the British Bigfoot one, will be, and it's an awful lot more focused than my conversation just been, as you know. So that'll be in the next. That's in the September issue, which I think is 221 or 222 or 421, 422. I beg your pardon. And that'll be in that one. But I've got more stuff coming up, and it's other than that, yeah, I'm going to start getting my website back together again when I can concentrate for more than 5 minutes, and I'll start putting things up. And I'm still writing my book, so yeah, I've been writing this. Last time we spoke 2 years ago, I was on chapter 3. I am now on chapter 4.5, so I've really moved along. By the time I'm 75, I'm going to have this bloody thing published, I promise you.
No, don't set me off, Stu. I've been trying to do mine for about 3 years, and I've got halfway through chapter one, and that's where it's been for the best part of 3 years. But I have found other things to keep me busy for the time being, but I'm hopefully...
You've got a lot on, mate. You really have got a lot on. So don't worry too much, definitely. Perhaps we should collaborate. That's maybe 5 chapters we've got between us there, mate.
Who knows?
Perhaps I was 65. You never know. Hey.
Never say never, Stu. Well, there's always an absolute pleasure, and we'll make sure we don't keep it too long next time. Thank you for joining us, Stu.
Good to see you, mate. Good to talk to you. I'll see you soon.